The views and opinions expressed by guests on Soda City Unleashed are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of CVETS. While we love sharing stories and insights from the veterinary world, this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. It is not a substitution for professional veterinary advice, diagnosis, or treatment. We always recommend consulting your primary veterinarian for any medical concerns regarding your pet. Welcome to Soda City Unleashed, where we decode pet health with some of the best vets and veterinary experts in Columbia, South Carolina. I'm your host, Emily White, and joining me today is Miss Allie Duncan, who is the head trainer at PALS. Hi, hey, Allie. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So we're kind of giggling because I had Allie Rich written down. You recently got married. Congratulations.
I did, back in April. It's still new to everybody. My team still calls me Allie Rich all the time, so no big deal at all.
I did the thing on Facebook where I like kept my name in the middle just because like it's, you know, it's hard.
It is hard for people when they go to find you and it's all of a sudden different. Yeah, it's confusing.
Right. Well, congratulations. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I've been training dogs for pretty much as long as I can remember. Literally when I was a little kid, I started going to those dog shows at theme parks with my family.
Cool.
And my brother's wife met him when I was in like early middle school years, and her first memory of me is sitting in our living room with a clicker trying to train our dog. So
love it.
That's pretty much my whole life has been dog training and animals, and I'm a horseback rider and all of that kind of stuff.
That's awesome. Okay, well, tell me about PALS. What is PALS and how did it get started?
PALS stands for Palmetto Animal Assisted Life Services. I know it's a very long name, but we just call it PALS. So PALS is an organization that kind of has a twofold mission. So one part of it is we train service dogs for people with disabilities, primarily focusing on PTSD, autism, and mobility. And then the other half of our mission is for animal assisted services, which basically means that we take our dogs in training into hospitals and sometimes nursing homes and things like that and run programming with them to kind of help those in the community and support them. So those are kind of both of our missions that we're working on all the time. Keeps us busy, but it's great, and the dogs are amazing. Jen Rogers is our founder. Her and her husband, Chuck Rogers, founded PALS back in 2007, which feels like forever ago now, but it actually started in her house.
Okay.
So if you can imagine, there was a bunch of dogs all in her house at once while that she was training to
lots
be service
dogs.
Lots
of clicker noises is what I'm imagining.
Lots of clicker sounds, lots of places everywhere, dogs just running around like crazy. And then eventually we moved into the place down on Grampian Hills Road where we are now.
It's really cool to be out in the community and with like different like the Richland County Sheriff's Office and Columbia Police Department, and you guys will always be like, oh, that's one of our dogs, or this is a PALS dog. That's really, it's fun to see that.
It's really cool to see them working in the community after placement too. Like anywhere CJ is or anywhere any of our previous, even our release dogs are, we're like, oh yeah, that's whoever, we did this and this with them while they were in training. So they all have a really cool story behind them, even if they don't make it to that full service placement.
Absolutely. What brought you to PALS to be the head trainer there?
Like I said, I've been involved with dogs pretty much my whole life. I actually didn't go to school for this, surprisingly. A lot of people are surprised by that. I was just really interested in it. So I did a lot of research myself, and I found some mentors and things like that growing up. And somewhere along the way, I found service dogs. And I thought it was really cool, all the things that dogs can do to help people. So that kind of made that my life's mission, to work with them. Talked for several hours with Jen and Liz. We all kind of determined that it was a good fit. And literally 2 weeks later, I moved from Illinois down here to South Carolina. So it was kind of a whirlwind, but it's been amazing. I love how small of a program we are, because we can keep good close contact with all of our clients. Like I know all the dogs I've placed and I talk to all their clients regularly. So it's really cool being able to have that connection with them.
So I'm interested, when you were like a little kid, did you have like a really bad dog and you were like, I will train you? Like how did a small child get interested in that?
To be honest, I think it really just came from seeing like the cool tricks that the dogs could do in the shows I was watching, and I was just like, How do you do that? Like, that's really cool. Because I'll be honest, our family dog could barely can't come when you called her. So
that's my dog now.
She wasn't a bad dog. She just didn't quite have the training. But that's okay. She was a family dog. She was very, very much loved. And she just kind of hung out and did her thing. But it made me very interested in how dogs learn and behavior theory and all of that. So I just kind of dove into it on my own and found some other people who are just as interested as me.
What kind of dogs does PALS train and how are they selected?
Primarily speaking, we train mobility dogs, PTSD dogs, and autism dogs. And our PTSD dogs can either be for veterans or civilians. We're actually, I don't want to say we're completely unique in that, but a lot of programs do cater specifically to veterans, which is amazing. Of course, we love our veterans and we do have a very high population that we serve there, but we do also serve the civilians with PTSD. And the autism, we do kids and adults. So it's really cool getting to serve a whole spectrum of that. And really the dogs kind of tell us what they want to do. So even sometimes as young as 6 months old, our dogs are showing an affinity for one thing or another. And we're like, oh, this dog's looking like it's going to end up being a PTSD dog or looking like it's going to be a mobility dog. The mobility dogs really like to work. And all they really want to do is like, yeah, I'll go tug something. I'll go pick something up. But if you were upset, they don't really care. They're like, eh, whatever. I'm going to go sit over here while you're having your moment over there. Gotcha. Whereas our PTSD dogs, autism dogs, are a little more intuitive. They'll come to you when they think you need something, or they'll just flop in your lap because they want to be cuddled. So stuff like that is just how they tell us exactly what they want to do.
So along those lines, I only kind of know this because I visited you guys a couple weeks ago, but mobility dogs, those dogs, tell me what those dogs are doing, what kinds of things.
Yeah, so mobility dogs can help in a variety of different ways. It really depends on what their clients need. So they can do things like opening doors, turning lights on and off, retrievals when their clients drop something. If someone has limited range of motion, they can carry things for someone. They can go get help in the house if someone needs it. Really, the possibilities are endless. We've trained a dog to flush a toilet for a client who needed help with that. So we tend to say to our clients, like, think of the things that take more energy than they should in a day. One of our clients specifically talks about, what can a normal able-bodied person do in 5 minutes? What that would take me 20 minutes. So like, what are those things that we could possibly have a dog help you with? Like pulling a jacket off. You never realize how easy it is to take off your socks until you might not be able to reach them. So we can have the dog help with that. And honestly, that's some of our dog's favorite tasks is that one. They think it's so fun. But yeah, they can do a whole range of things and it really just depends on the client. Getting creative is a huge part of what we do, of what the dogs can do to help them.
Gotcha. And so with autism dogs and PTSD, mm-hmm. that's more of like the feelings kind of thing, like mm-hmm. calming people down?
Yeah. So there's a lot of science that backs heart rate and like serotonin and all of that kind of thing. So there's certain pressure points on your body that when triggered can help lower those things, lower the heart rate, help calm someone down, ground them. So we teach the dogs to specifically target those points. So the tops of the thighs is one. We teach the dog to come up across in a hug. And they can stay there for up to 10 minutes and help really lower that heart rate and ground someone. We do tactile stimulation cues. So if someone's disassociating or something, they can use the dog's fur or their collar to kind of bring them back into reality. All stuff like that. We can teach the dogs to keep a lookout behind them or behind their handler and kind of let them know via their body language that someone's coming up behind them to avoid a startle when it's not expected.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Would those things apply to PTSD and autism?
Yeah, they could definitely apply to both. It really depends. So our autism clients, some of them are kids. So a lot of what happens is we'll teach like a forward cue. So the dog will walk with the child instead of the parent who is actually handling the dog to help kind of bring the kid a sense of belonging with the dog. And it also opens up those social doors for the children too, who might have a little bit of a harder time connecting. They can be like, hey, this is my dog so-and-so. And that's what it does for me. As well as those pressure type cues. But yeah, it can apply to both. It can really, we also do combo dogs. So we have mobility dogs that also do PTSD for people who need that and vice versa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Would a dog who is paired with a child, mm-hmm. would they grow up with the child and then eventually the child would take over?
Typically speaking, it ends up being that the parent is the primary handler for the working life of the dog. Usually the child is placed around 5 to 8 years old is typical. It sometimes is a little older. We'll do as young as 5. But by the time the child then grows up, the dog is already used to following the cues from the mm-hmm. parent, and it would be a little bit more difficult to switch it to the child. So they can definitely start incorporating the child in giving cues, but the dog would most likely always turn to the parent for the ultimate cues in that scenario. But they can always apply for a successor dog when they're a little older. So once they're 16, they can apply to handle a dog for themselves. And if that happens, then we can train a dog that would listen primarily to the child. It just depends on the situation.
Interesting. Yeah. Things you don't, I mean, I wouldn't really think about before. Yeah, right. Can you walk us through the training process? I know that it's like a very big ask, but you get them when they're as young as what, 6 months?
No, we get them as young as 8 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
we have a breeding program. It's a fairly small one, but if we whelp a litter or have a litter in our building or with our volunteers, we actually start training with a process called early neurological stimulation at 3 days old. So we start doing things like stimulating their toes with a Q-tip and like putting them on a hot pack or a cold pack to just start stimulating their brain. So they really start thinking and things and develop in that way. And studies have been shown that the dogs are a lot more stable and even have better immunity to some diseases with the early neurological stimulation. But formally speaking, they enter training at 8 weeks. And we start with like really basic cues, you know, their name, all their manners, not allowed to jump on me or bite me or anything like that, potty training. It honestly kind of starts similar to how you would think a pet training would. Sure. So you're sit, you're down, that kind of thing. Just with a few more rules. A lot of people don't think about like things that happen with a puppy will affect what they do as an adult. So we have to think about the end goal of it being a service dog, because, you know, everyone sees the 10-pound puppy and is like, oh, it's okay if it jumps on me. And we're like, no, because if it goes to mobility client later, if it thinks it's okay to jump, that could hurt somebody. So we have to keep all that in mind while we train the little ones. But it's basically a really long path of obedience, task training, and public access. We have a whole curriculum, and it is like a school curriculum. They start in pre-K and they finish in college, and it kind of progresses as they do in duration, difficulty, level of distraction, all of that, until they're finally finished and ready to go work with their clients. And it takes about 2 years. So it's quite the process.
Would you say licking is one of the things that you teach them not to do?
We do our best. We do have some dogs that are kind of natural lickers, and it's a lot harder to get them to stop. Those typically end up going to more of a PTSD type placement who like that tactile stimulation. Mm-hmm. But some people who have autism have sensory problems, right. So the licking can't happen. So we do try and restrict it. We do have a cue called Kiss, so that we can teach the dog to lick on cue. But yeah, we do typically try to restrict it unless we ask for it, just to make sure that they're not causing any discomfort in anybody.
That's one thing I wish I could go back and train my dog to stop doing.
Yeah.
Sometimes he attacks me with the licks. So we kind of talked about some specific tasks and skills that your dogs are trained to perform. Are there any that come to mind that are just like super... One that I think of is turning the lights on and off.
Yeah.
That is something that these dogs can do.
Yeah. It's
is there
really cool.
A surprising one that comes to mind?
Most recently, I now consider it one of like the most difficult / challenging tasks I've ever trained, is I'm teaching a dog to pull a half gallon of juice off the bottom shelf of a grocery store and hand it to their person. So it's quite difficult, but it's really cool now that the dog has it wow. And can do it. I just practiced it today and the dog nailed it, and I was so proud of that dog after so long of working on it. So they just blow my mind all the time. I mean, I get the question frequently, like, what's the hardest thing for the dogs to learn? And I'm like, it really just depends on the dog. Like, some of them, the hardest thing is learning how to settle next to me because all they want to do is work. And some of them, the hardest thing is teaching them to pull juice off a shelf.
Right.
So it really just depends. I think it's really cool that they can pull jackets off of people, retrieve canes without tripping on them. Like, all of that stuff is just wild to me that their little brains can comprehend that and like really want to do it.
Right. I'm thinking about when we were visiting and you had a dog open the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was supposed to grab the water bottle, but he grabbed a bottle of margarita mix,
yeah.
Which is just
funny,
I mean,
little mistakes they make. Yeah.
You like, know. Oh, well, okay. Well, yeah, you did what I asked you to do, but.
Yeah, someone put it on the wrong shelf because he knows to grab what's on the bottom shelf. And he was like, oh, well, there's more things here. I guess I get to pick what I want.
This one looks fun.
I have a friend whose dog retrieved her a bottle of ranch because someone put the ranch in the spot of her water bottle.
Man.
So. It did happen.
He did
sometimes.
What he was supposed to
yep.
do.
He got the thing in the spot that he was supposed to get it from.
The humans have to be trained.
Exactly.
Too,
the
right?
humans have to have things in order for them to get it right.
Speaking of the humans, how do you match a dog with the right person?
It's a really good question. So our clients go through a lot of an interview, like a huge interview process that involves a pretty long application, you know, just so we can understand your needs and all of that kind of thing. And then we do some home visits. We do some in-person interviews. We do an interview in public. Just so they can get a feel of working with the dog in public, because it does make you an additional person wide and draws a lot of attention. So mm-hmm. it's a very important step. But if you go through all that and you're approved, we do what we call speed dating with dogs. So we invite clients in, they're called client and waiting sessions, and they meet like 3 to 4 dogs per session at 5-10 minutes each. And they just run through some cues that I teach them. We're looking for how they respond to like chains of cues that we're giving them, how they remember it, things like that, and how they work with each dog's different personality. So I usually try and find 3 to 4 dogs with pretty different personalities just to see how they respond to them. And if we see, sometimes we see a dog that meets someone and we're just like, boom, done. Like they fell in love with them instantly. That was perfect. And sometimes we're like, okay, well, we didn't really see a match this time. We'll come back.
So once you find the right match, how do you hand off?
We do a week of virtual team training first. So we call them 30 days before and we say, hey, we have a dog for you. This is the date we're starting. We do a week of virtual where we go through a bunch of book work and manuals and all that, you know, the quote unquote boring stuff. I don't think it's boring, but there's no dogs involved. And then on the first day of in-person, they get to meet their match. Until then, they have no idea which dog is theirs. We don't tell them because really something can happen up until the day of team training. You never know. They're dogs. They're going to make dog decisions sometimes. So the first day they meet their match and literally we put them in the middle of a room and I stand behind a door and I send the dog out to them in front of everybody and everyone gets to see them meet their match. Aww. And then it's usually about 3 weeks of training where we teach the client everything the dog learned in 2 years in 3 weeks. Wow. So people tend to call it boot camp. It's very intensive. The dogs learn on average 70 cues. So we have to teach the client how to be proficient in about 70 cues in 3 weeks. That's quite a challenge, but it's the most rewarding thing ever.
How do you explain to the dog that, like, hey, I know I'm the one that's been giving you all these cues, but now they're the one that needs to give you all these cues?
It can be difficult, and honestly, it can be a little heart-wrenching, because really, the second I pass off the dog, I can't look at the dog anymore. So even if the dog is looking at me for, like, hey, what do? I literally have to turn my back on it and let them figure it out with the client, because it has to learn how to problem solve. The client looks different. They talk different than I do, so they have to learn how to problem solve with them, but sometimes you're just like, I'm sorry.
turn away. I don't know how you do that.
It's difficult sometimes, but when it all comes together and they start to bond, it's all worth it. But the first couple days are always a little bit like, sorry.
Sorry, buddy.
I love you. I just love you from afar. They have to go through a 6-month process where no one but them interacts with the dog unless it's an emergency situation. Mm. And that's just to help them bond with them. So the dog learns that they're the best thing in the world now. And then they usually come back to visit us after 6 months and we're like, Let me pet the dog
and again. Like, I know you.
Yeah, they all get really excited and they go nuts and jump all over us. And we're like, you know what? Maybe
excuse
this time.
It, right? For this one
it's okay.
Time.
It's been like, 6 months.
It's a reunion.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite story about a dog and a handler situation?
Oh my goodness. I have tons of stories. my favorite one, we had a veteran he was a flight nurse before he came to us. I think he was in for 20 something years. So he was in for a long time. And post his service, he had PTSD and he had not left his house in about 20 years. During team training, I asked him, we were sitting in a Panera because we take them out to restaurants and things. And I said, hey, when was the last time that you went out to a restaurant? He said, I think it's been 20 years. And the first day he met his dog, he was sitting in the middle of the room. I sent her out and that dog never looked back. Instant love connection, never worried about me again. It was crazy. Of course, I was a little like, all right, cool. Thanks.
Fine. Bye.
Exactly.
All the memes.
But honestly, it was so beautiful to watch. And they are still the best team to this day. He's now like going out and reading to his grandkids' classes. Like he's going out and doing all kinds of things he didn't think was possible because of her. So those are the best stories that we look
for. Beautiful. Yeah. That's like you couldn't write that any more pure.
Yeah.
What's one moment, a different moment maybe, in your career that's reminded you why this work matters so much?
Yeah, well, we had a dog we placed last year, near the end of the last year, another PTSD client. I don't know why it was both bad, but whatever. And another situation where he just hadn't left his house in a while. Leaving his house caused him a lot of anxiety. He had the hope to move out, but that really wasn't in the realm of possibility for him. Well, then he got his dog, and he just got engaged about a few weeks ago.
What?
And we're like, what? So watching him, like, soar with the help of this dog is absolutely crazy. And it's,
we're he all said, so not proud. Only am I leaving the house.
Exactly. We were dating. Like, wow. Yeah. It was an outrageous turnaround. And it was so, so inspiring to watch that happen.
Wow. I mean, you think about people who are able to do everyday things again, who maybe haven't in the exactly. past. But you don't think about stuff like that. Like, he was able to, I mean, change his whole life.
Exactly. Everything turned around for him. He's going out like multiple times a week now. I think he just posted a picture of going to lunch with his dog. Like, they're just the best partners now. And wow. he's just living life to the fullest now. And that's what we do this for.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions about service dogs or the training process?
That's a good question. Most people think service dogs don't ever get to just be a dog. That's probably the biggest one I get. I've even heard when we're out in public training them, people are like, oh, that poor dog. And I'm like, no, this dog gets to go everywhere with their favorite person. They get to do their favorite things. They all think work is the best. Right. We don't place them if they don't enjoy it. So if there's a dog that's just like, you know, work life's not for me, they just get to go be a pet. And that's what they do. We don't force them to do anything. That's totally fine. But the dogs that do get to do it love it. And so they literally are living their best life every day. And if they didn't get their off time, they wouldn't work. Just kind of like us, we need the work-life balance.
Right.
They do too. We actually require that they get dog play, like play dates every week after they're placed. So they're required to get like a certain amount of walks, certain amount of play time, like all of that to make sure that they still get that dog time, even though they're working hard.
Yeah, there's no, you can't you tell can't. A dog to not be a
exactly.
dog.
Exactly, it's a dog. And I tell our clients that all the time. I'm like, listen, they're service dogs, but they're going to make mistakes because at the end of the day, it's still a dog. And they're going to decide that that steak in the grocery store smells great one day and take a sneaking sniff over to it.
Right.
That's okay. They're a dog. It's allowed as long as it doesn't become consistent.
Right. Just like us. We're humans.
Exactly.
You know, we make mistakes too. And most of these dogs are labs and goldens, right?
Yep. So labs and goldens.
They tend to be derpy, you know?
Yeah. They're very goofy, especially our goldens, our silly little kids. But yeah, they can be very goofy and they certainly act like it sometimes, which sometimes is the best part. They keep a smile on their client's face no matter what.
What would you say is the most challenging part of your job?
I would say the most challenging part, honestly, is probably educating like the general public on it, but also making sure that the dogs are having the best time and that we're always doing the right thing by the dog. I guess challenging might not be the right word for that, but it's definitely something that's always in the forefront of our minds where we're like, okay, well, this dog is now showing this adolescent behavior. It happens. They're one-year-old dogs. It's like, is this because the dog doesn't want to work like this, mm-hmm. or is it because they're an adolescent? So it's figuring out the best thing for the dog, and that's all we can do is figure out what we think the best route for that dog is. So I would say that's the thing that's always in the forefront of our minds, whether it's challenging or not. It's the thing we think about the most.
Right. And it's, welfare. I mean, same thing in the vet med industry is they can't speak for themselves.
Exactly.
So we have to advocate for them and your situation too, because I mean, if a dog doesn't want to work, it doesn't want to work.
Yeah, because the worst thing is if a dog really doesn't like it and we're like, oh, it'll be fine, like I think it'd be great, and then we place them and then it doesn't do the job it needs to do, mm-hmm. then it's just frustrating for the client, it's frustrating right. for the dog, no one likes it, yeah. and everyone's just upset by the end.
Yeah.
So the welfare of the dog is always the number one in our head, all the way through training, all the way through placement and beyond. That's the biggest thing that we're always worried about.
So you mentioned that you would think that the general public would think that letting go of the dogs is the hardest part for you.
Yep.
One of my questions is, how do you emotionally handle it when the dogs leave you to go to new homes? It sounds like you're good at compartmentalizing.
I mean, we cry for sure.
There are tears.
I mean, of course they are. I mean, some of these dogs I literally caught coming out of their mama, and then 2 years later I'm sending them off to probably not be seen for quite a long right. time. So of course we cry, but you kind of go into it knowing that mm-hmm. they're not your dog and they're going to go off to really do something special for these people, whether they become a release dog or a service dog. They all do exactly what they're meant to do. So watching them leave, while it hurts at the moment, it's really cool to watch them do what their full potential is, because we know they're not going to be happy hanging out with us for their whole life. You can actually kind of tell around 2 years old, they really start to dislike being there. Like, they kind of grow
really?
Out of the pals
right?
environment.
Yeah.
So they hit 2 years old and they're kind of like just sitting in a corner at recess. We're they ready. Don't really want to do anything like with the other dogs. They're like, I just want to work, man. Like, can you just find me something to do?
That's
so
funny.
That makes it worth it. And just watching them work, you know that even though it hurts at the time, it's better for them.
Absolutely. So how can people support PALS and its mission?
Well, we're, of course, always looking for weekend fosters. The dogs live with us full time during the week and train all week, but they go home to learn home manners and just be a dog on the weekends while they're training. So we always need weekend fosters and pup sitters. The pup sitters are the ones who take over for the fosters when they're not available. Building volunteers, we need people to come learn to take dogs on public access outings. We need people who can sew up dog toys. Literally, whatever you like to do, we can probably utilize your skills. Yeah, we can definitely utilize anybody's help who wants to get involved. And we'll give you some puppy cuddles in return. They're the worth best. It. Yeah, right.
Sometimes you volunteer and you don't get puppy cuddles.
Exactly. So. At the end of the day, if you've like been raking gravel in the yard all day, I'll walk over and plop a four-month-old puppy in your lap. Worth it.
Do the dogs, thinking of the ones that you have right now, mm-hmm. Do any of them have like funny quirks or personalities that particularly stand out?
So I have this dog. His name is Morgan. I adore him. He's hilarious. He's one of the biggest dogs in the program. I think he's 75 pounds. I think he was in the video that you guys did a few weeks ago, turning on the lights. He loves to work, but he's half golden retriever. And that golden side is strong. He thinks that he should be the only dog to get pets always. Mm. So if you're sitting in a yard with him and a bunch of other dogs and he looks over and sees you petting another dog, he will come over and just slowly sink himself between you and the other dog. Like, no. Pets, it's come me. To me. Yeah, it's no, me. My turn. Yeah. And he's just so funny. You have to be like, dude, like, I can pet other dogs. So they all have their funny quirks, but that just always makes me laugh. And when you do start petting him, he'll start like throwing his body around. He gets so excited.
He's like, yes, I did it.
Yeah. I also have a one-year-old who anytime you let him out of the kennel, it's like he has springs in his feet. He doesn't jump on you, but he'll just like jump next to you and he's be like a so excited. He's like, am I working? Am I going to recess? What am I doing? I don't care. I'm just excited. And he just jumps around all the time. I call him Tigger because he just bounces.
Love it.
Yeah, he's hilarious. So
cute. I remember, I think it was Joe.
Oh, yeah.
At recess, he was just like, I'm going to sit in this corner.
Doesn't want to be involved. Nope.
I don't care to play. I don't care to sniff you. I'm going to sit right here.
Yeah, he wants to be pet by people, but if you put him in a yard with other dogs, he's like, why would I want to do that? Like, how about I just come sit next to you? Because if you let him out, he'll sit next to you and want to be loved all day. But other dogs, nah. Not interested.
I'm good. It's so interesting how different they are.
Yeah, right. Some of them are all about the other dogs, right. And some of them are just like, take it or leave it, whatever. Gross.
Yeah, love that. What are some behind the scenes moments at PALS that would surprise people?
Oh man, there's a lot that goes on the day to day. We're always running around like crazy. I mean, we do a lot of like pulling our whole strings of dogs out at once, which I think surprises people. So we really don't like our dogs to spend a ton of time just like idling in kennels.
Sure.
I mean, of course, when they're little, they have to learn how to relax and just like hang out in the kennel. But we don't like them to spend a ton of time in there. That's not fair to them. So I usually will have a couple dogs behind my desk in an X-Pen. I'll have a couple dogs on tie-outs in my room. I have another X-Pen set up for puppies. And they're all just kind of everywhere doing a lot of things all at once. So sometimes it feels a bit chaotic, but there's a purpose behind all of it. So I think people are generally surprised if they happen to show up when I'm doing that, that they're just kind of everywhere, just existing. And that's great because people assume that they're very regimented and whatever. Right. But no, they're having a great time just hanging out with a Kong and a tug rope over there in the corner. Like, they're doing great. On the flip side, we do also have times where people will come in and I will have all eight of my advanced dogs on a place at one time working on it while I'm vacuuming out kennels or something. So I think people are really surprised when we have giant chunks of the dogs out at once doing something, because you don't think about that. You just think of training one at a time.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. When we came, you guys have different like sections of your the backyard for recess. So there must have been, I mean, how many dogs do you guys have right now?
We have 20 in training right now and they all go out for recess at the same time. So we have 5 yards and they get split between that based on, you know, who gets along the best, boys and girls, because, you know, they're not all fixed yet. Boys and girls are separated, and then who gets along best with each other gets to play with each other. And we do that 5 times a day. They get recesses.
Wow.
So they're out playing and have a ton of free time every single day.
So as we close out, what is one thing that you wish more people understood about service dogs?
That they love what they do. I think that would be the biggest thing. They're not forced to do anything. They absolutely adore working. A lot of people think that if I took my treat pouch off, they wouldn't work anymore, but that's not true. I mean, we give them the rewards just like you and I would get a paycheck. They get their paycheck in the form of kibble, and they happily accept it, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't work without it. They love to work. I think that's the biggest thing about them is when you actually see them working or training, you see how excited they are. And that's the coolest thing about it is how much they love it.
What are ways people can get in touch with you guys?
Our website is pals.org. That's the best way to get in touch with us. We have the contact us form on there and several email addresses on there as well. I would say that has the best forms of contact. That's also where all of our applications are to find more information on everything.
If a young person is listening to this and they want to grow up and do what you do, what advice would you give them?
Just learn as much as you can about as many different methods as you can. So, I'm a positive reinforcement trainer. PALS uses all positive reinforcement methods. I always encourage everybody to do their own research on every type of method to find out what's best for you and what works best. But find a mentor in your area that will let you shadow them and work with them on just how to see what the dog is telling you, their body language, how to see how the dog learns best. Just learn as much as you can throughout as much time as you have free time, and just slowly start getting experience with hands-on dogs. I think I started like in my teenage years getting hands-on friends' dogs, just practicing different things I was learning. So the more experience you can get, the better it's going to be.
Gotcha. If someone's listening and they're interested in applying for a dog, how do they do that?
That's all on our website. So pals.org, both our service dog thing application is on there, and also our event application is on there as well. If they want us to come out and teach about service dogs or do a program with the dogs, all of that's on our website.
And we will link that in the show notes for sure. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was so informative. Until next time, give your pets an extra pet for us. And thank you for joining us for Soda City Unleashed.